supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Autism Awareness Month comes to a close this week. The month traditionally includes opportunities to discuss autism and to share ideas among those within the communities that serve, support, and care for individuals with autism here in the United States. Well, in other pockets of the world, there is no such thing as Autism Awareness Month, but there are many caring people doing the best they can to address this disorder and its many manifestations. So today, on Voices in the Family, we've decided to do our best to give you a sense of autism as it is recognized, accepted, or not, and addressed in some other cultures. We'll do this by speaking with parents from different countries and cultures. We'll hear from an authority on cultural, racial, and ethnic differences around autism, and we'll talk with someone who has autism and has traveled the world. And you've probably heard of him. Diagnosed with autism as a young age and recommended for institutionalization, Stephen Shore went on to get his PhD and lectures on the topic of autism around the world. He has spoken in most states in this country and has traveled the world, including China and New Zealand, just to name a few of the countries he's been at. I asked him to tell us about what autism looks like around the world and how people respond to it and treat it.
What I found is that autism is the same anywhere. People with autism act and move in similar ways. It is a type of built-in community, because in addition to people with autism being the same, there's great commonality between parents and schools. I mean, I've seen picture exchange communication systems used in all sorts of languages and all sorts of locations. And
What do you mean, Steve? What do you mean first by picture exchange communication?
Sure. What that is, it's a system of standardized pictures representing things such as, say, a refrigerator or food or even where the bathroom is. And in that way, it's a sort of international language. Given that people with autism tend to be visually based, it is often easier for us, especially those of us with difficulties interacting verbally, to understand pictures.
What are the similarities do you see in the way families respond to autism in their children, and what are the differences you see cross-country?
Well, the similarities, especially when the child is young, families seem to go through stages of initially shock, then gathering information. After a huge amount of gathering, often there is a desire to rid their child of autism or to cure autism. Eventually there gets to a point where families realize that, well, this autism is here to stay, and let's see what we can do to work with
and you,
it.
And you find that across countries, across cultures?
The next step that I was going to say is that gets tempered by cultural assumptions and beliefs about disability.
For example?
In the Far East, it at least was commonly thought that a child having a disability was the result of the parents doing something wrong. And thus there was great shame in even admitting or letting other people know that your child had a disability, and it tended to be hidden. In some countries around the world, actually a number of them, there is no special education law like we have in the United States. which brings people with differences into a more visible situation and greater acceptance.
This shame issue is a big deal, Stephen. And, you know, we have it to a certain extent in this country.
Yes, we do.
Have you experienced a country or a culture where there is no shame associated with autism?
I think probably the best way to look at it is not so much entire countries, but pockets of best practice. So, for example, I went on a trip to New Zealand. I visited this school where it just seemed, it was accepted and it seemed very normal to cater to a person's strengths. So in other words, the curriculum for their children with autism and other conditions as well was based all around their special interests. So if the child had a particular interest in, say, airplanes, the curriculum was built around that, and the child was taught math, reading, social studies, or whatever else.
Wow.
Another fascinating aspect I found was when I was in South Korea, where I found that only the top-performing students at universities are permitted to become special educators, and special educators are paid more than regular educators.
Well, hearing what you've said about New Zealand, I'm actually going to consider giving up everything in this country and go to New Zealand and start my education all over again.
It might not be a bad idea.
I want to hear you talk about best practices. You've seen best practices in some of the most poor and desolated places. Tell us about it.
Oh, yes. Fascinating. About 6 years ago, I remember visiting a school on the outskirts of Beijing. School was set up by a pediatrician who had no connection to autism except for the fact that she thought that children with autism needed to be educated. And what they set up in this dilapidated old building was a program that seemed primarily based on applied behavior analysis, rewarding desired behaviors and ignoring or turning away from undesired behaviors. And then there was the sensory integration component. And
In Beijing,
to help these students balance, you might say, their sensory receptors.
How did this doctor know about this?
I think it was basically what she and the faculty and staff at the school were able to glean from the internet and books they had managed to acquire.
Wow.
Yeah, really, really fascinating. And what I find in particular the countries that don't have a special education law like we have in the United States, there's a strong parental component participation in setting up and running these schools.
Is the incidence of autism different in different countries?
What I find is that in the more developed countries, having the wherewithal to count children with autism, their rates seem to be about the same as the United States. There are some cities, for example, such as, I remember doing a conference in New Delhi, where I was told they didn't do a count, but since the United States was saying, and in that time it was 1 in 150, we're going to say 1 in 152 because there's an awful lot of people with autism.
Mm. Do you find differences in different states in this country in the way autism is dealt with?
Yeah, I do. I find that there's a pretty significant concentration of services and work being done in autism in Massachusetts, particularly the Boston area, greater New York, which also includes New Jersey. There's a good amount going on in Philadelphia. Kansas, University of Kansas, seems to be doing good work. Texas seems to be putting a lot of money into conferences and to working things out for people with autism, as well as the state of Minnesota.
And where should we avoid moving to?
That's hard to say. There may be a state, for example, such as, and I'm just going to pull this out of my hat because I have complete lack of awareness of this state, and that is Wyoming. I have not been to Wyoming. It's one of the five states left. And I have not heard of a autism conference happening in Wyoming. It doesn't mean it hasn't, but I just haven't heard of it. So if I were to move to Wyoming with a child on the spectrum, I'd really look carefully at the particular community to see if it could provide the services that my child needs before making that move.
That was author, educator, and lecturer Stephen Schuer. He presents and consults internationally on issues pertinent to autism in adults, and he himself has autism. We taped our interview last week. Stephen's at the White House today to attend an event commemorating Autism Awareness Day. We continue to look at autism in different cultures by listening to the comments of three local women who recently attended a support group for mothers of autistic children in the Juniata Park section of North Philadelphia. They are locals with perspectives that say quite a bit about their strong Latin roots.
My name is Dr. Jahaira Marquez, and I'm a psychologist at the Albert Einstein Medical Center in the Department of Pediatrics. Here we see children with developmental disabilities, learning disabilities, attention deficit, also with autism. During the last 2 years, I have been given a basic autism training in Spanish for families and professionals that work with children with autism. There's not a lot of research that indicates that Latinos or Hispanic react in a different way to a diagnosis of autism, or that they treat their children in a different way from other families in other ethnic groups. However, what I do believe makes a difference is the ability to receive services or receive information in their native language. So the fact that the information is available in Spanish, or that a support group is available in Spanish and English, the parents are able to make a connection with others and just use that language that is emotional to them to be able to express themselves and share their experiences. Lo que nos hemos dado cuenta es que los padres están interesados en hablar sobre el estrés que causa el tener un niño con autismo, pero no hay una palabra como stress en español, sino que se puede decir tensión, o usamos esa palabra prestada del inglés, que es estrés. And what I'm trying to say is that parents are really interested in talking about how stressful it could be to have a child with autism. But really, in Spanish, that word stress really doesn't exist. We use the word that is very similar to stress, which is tension, right? But it doesn't really quite bring that of meaning of stress. So we come up with our own borrowed word, and we call it estrés. Families just laugh about this because we don't have a word, but we do feel it, and we feel it constantly.
I'm Jennifer Taylor, and I am a member of Loving My Mocha, Mothers of Children with Autism. I have 5 children, and I do have a son who is autistic. He is 9 years old. One thing that I've noticed in my own family, you know, my mother coming from a very large Hispanic Puerto Rican culture, big family, brothers and sisters, she was very afraid for me to even mention the word autism around her or even the family. It was very taboo, something that shouldn't be spoken of. When I did first bring it up to her, she basically said that, you know, the child doesn't have autism. You know, you just need to, you know, teach him differently and he'll learn more and understand more. And as the years went on, she did notice that, you know, things were different with him. And she still was concerned about me being so open and honest about autism. I think that she was raised in an era or a time where things were swept under the rug, kept hush-hush, something quiet, especially when it has to do with your children. Her biggest fear was people not accepting him for who he was or who he is. The word autism to her is something very scary. And I think for the Latino community, it's something that they're not accustomed to or aware of, or they weren't brought up, you know, knowing about diagnosis or things of that nature. It's still a struggle for her today, you know, and he's been diagnosed since he was 3 years old and he is 9. But in the last 6 years, I think that the more open that I have become with her, and she's has seen a difference what early intervention has done in his life, you know, she's a little bit open, but it's still a thing where in the back of her mind, it's okay, you don't have to use that word so often.
My name is Zariah Nieves. I have two children, my son Eddie and my daughter Noemi. My son, although doesn't fall in the spectrum of autism, he does have certain characteristics. I've been challenged to help him through those challenges. I think in the Latino community, sometimes there's a hush of where certain things are either taboo or just looked down upon. You don't even speak it. It could be in your face, and a lot of people just act as if it's not even there. It's not just with autism, but with several things. I don't know if it's part of the culture or if it's unique to our culture. A lot of people choose not to even acknowledge it for fear that they might be looked at as if they did something wrong or God punished them or, you know, maybe competition between people, you know, my kid is better than yours type thing. I don't know. There's still a lot of old school thinking. And we want to encourage people and help them to see that it's okay. You're not the only one. And there's no need to feel ashamed. There's just nothing wrong with autism or with the autistic child. It's just, we just got to figure a different way of helping him or her along.
That was Autism as Seen, Experienced, and Lived With by Three Latino Mothers. That was produced by Voices in the Family's very own producer, Jennifer Lynn. After the break, we'll hear from David Mandel. He's the Associate Director of the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Program for Mindfulness will feature a meditation weekend on May 21st to explore how mindfulness and meditation are powerful tools for healing, growth, and stress management. Events will include a professional conference on mindfulness and psychotherapy and an evening lecture and full-day workshop with Tara Brock, psychotherapist and best-selling author of Radical Acceptance. For more information about these or other programs beginning in May, online at pennmedicine.org/mindfulness or 215-615-2775.
Cornwall Manor supports WHYY. A continuing care retirement community in Cornwall, Lebanon County, is only a short drive from Philadelphia. Cornwall Manor is now accepting reservations for their brand new Woodside apartment homes at their expanded campus. Woodside offers a variety of floor plan styles and access to all of the amenities and services that are available at Cornwall Manor for a great value. To find out about an event near you, cornwallmanor.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Today we're opening up a conversation on the topic of autism and how it's seen and handled in different countries and different cultures throughout the world. We continue this with Dr. David Mandel. He's the Associate Director of the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital here in Philadelphia. He's researched cultural, racial, and ethnic differences around autism. He spoke with Mike and Scott, who asked him about his findings.
Most of the research I've done has been in the United States, looking at differences in age of diagnosis and the type of treatment children with autism get depending on their ethnicity or their race or socioeconomic status. And we find, as is probably not surprising, that children from lower socioeconomic status groups get diagnosed much later than other children, and the quality of the intervention they get once they are diagnosed is worse. We also find that African-American children and Latino children are diagnosed later and have very different patterns of treatment than white children.
What kind of different patterns of treatment are we seeing?
One of the most striking findings is that African-American children are much less likely to be receiving psychotropic medications than white children.
And do you have any idea why that might be?
I think there are cultural differences in how people view psychotropic medications and their role. In a best-case scenario, those medications can be an important adjunct to other behavioral psychosocial treatments. And in a best-case scenario, they increase children's ability to learn. In a worst-case scenario, they become chemical restraints, and that they are used in some ways to compensate for a lack of appropriate behavioral intervention. And I think that sometimes African-American families who may be living in communities in which they have less access to quality of care are more see medications as potentially chemically restraining and potentially changing their children in unwanted ways. And so they're either more likely to reject the medication or are more likely to notice unwanted side effects or to respond to unwanted side effects when the medication is administered.
Now, you spoke about the age of diagnosis and that children, African-American and Latino children, are diagnosed at later ages. When do they typically get a diagnosis?
I think that when children get a diagnosis is sort of a changing target. One of the things we've noticed looking at national data, which is very encouraging, is that on average the age of diagnosis for children with autism is decreasing over time. But we do find that, on average, African-American children are diagnosed sometimes as much as a year later than white children, and Latino children are diagnosed somewhere in the middle.
And do you think that's an issue of awareness, or what are your thoughts there?
I think there are a lot of potential reasons for that finding. Some of it may have to do with awareness and interpretation of symptoms. So for a child to, if you think about the diagnostic process from the beginning, the first part is somebody notices that there's something unusual about this child's behavior, and usually that's the parent. And so that means that parents have some expectations about child development and awareness of developmental milestones. And so if families and parents are not aware of that, then they may not even bring up the behavior as concerning to a healthcare professional. A second is that you have to then see that behavior as having some medical etiology or being medically concerning. So you may be aware of the behavior and think it's unusual, but not believe or understand that there's something that can be done about that behavior, or that behavior may indicate a developmental problem with the child. So that's the parent part. We also need to think about the clinician part and the interaction of the clinician and the parent. So clinicians may believe erroneously that the prevalence of autism is less or lower in ethnic minority groups, and make some of their diagnostic decisions based on that.
So what are people like yourself doing to be more what's called culturally competent, to be able to reach out to families from all different backgrounds and to be effective in their interactions with them?
I think there are at least two approaches to reaching these families. The first is to develop materials that specifically speaks to their concerns. One issue is that a lot of the materials that are developed are only in English. And so if you're talking about families for whom English is a second language, one of the first priorities is translating that that information. But translating the information isn't enough. There may be cultural differences in how child development is perceived and what's important. I'll give you an example. Tamara Daly has done some research in India showing that the first thing that Indian families recognize about their child with autism is a failure to socially connect with other people, because that's a high priority in that culture. In the United States, the most common first concern is language development, since language is a higher priority here. So a big part about developing culturally specific and culturally competent materials is working with people from those cultures to understand what's salient, what's important, what should materials that talk about child development focus on, and then how do we help families where a developmental delay like autism is suspected.
That was Mike and Scott. She was talking with David Mandel of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. David's also attending today's autism awareness events at the White House. Well, we'll continue to look at autism around the world. And now we'll take a look at what's happening in the Netherlands, where my guest, Pim Donkersloot, lives. Pim is a developmental psychologist who works with autistic children. He has two children on the autism spectrum, and he's written a book about his family called Autism is a problem for the entire family. He joins me by phone from Amsterdam. Welcome to the show, Pim.
Yes, how are you? I'm okay here.
Good.
And having an exceptional week over here, because since 1903 we are the warmest country in Europe.
that's
something else. But it's nice to know, because everybody here is in an ecstatic, very interactive mood.
That's wonderful. Let me give out the phone numbers, Pim. Our number, if you want to join us, is 888-477-9499. We're looking at autism in different cultures. We're looking at the Netherlands now. After our break, we're going to be looking at how autism's treated in Egypt and Morocco. So again, the number is 888-477-9499. Pim, when we spoke to you before the show, you said your son Johan was low functioning and in a residential treatment center. Tell us about Johan.
Johan is now a 31-year-old man. Yeah, I still consider him as my little boy, like all parents do. But Johan was not diagnosed before he was 6 years. You know, we're talking about early 80s. And then the treatment on autism was virtually in its embryonal phase. So, which meant that, for example, when we saw the interactive problem with Johan, I still got from a psychiatrist over here the refrigerator parent.
Yeah.
So, because I was highly educated, and my wife as well, meant that we were that mainly the father was the cause of autism of my son. And that was kind of shocking and happily, because I studied already and knew already somewhat about developmental psychology, and of course something about autism, that this was a view from the early 50s.
So at the time, you knew that what you were hearing was wrong. When did you get your diagnosis of autism? Did you make it?
No. Thanks to my father-in-law. Yeah, my first Johan. I have to clarify this. He is a son of my first marriage. So, but when I got married with Jill, actually from Philadelphia, and that was 25 years ago. The year before, in 86, I guess, 85, 86, thanks to my father-in-law, maybe you know him, Dr. Herbert Adler,
He's
a psychiatrist in Philadelphia, he connected me with Dr. Bertram Ruttenberg, maybe you know as for you as well.
Yeah, also
he was,
in,
at that time,
also in
well,
Philadelphia.
He's pushing 80, 90s, I think, already.
Yeah.
But he was one of the autism experts in the States. And thanks to him, I finally got the proper diagnosis on Johan while he was already 7 years old.
I do have to tell you, as a slight diversion in the category of 6 degrees of separation, I know your father-in-law quite well, Herb Adler. He is at Jefferson. He's been on the show several times, and I consider him a friend of mine. The last time he was on the show, he was on with another guest, and after the show was done, all three of us realized that all three of us had grandchildren on the autism spectrum.
Oh.
So kindred spirits.
Yeah, he's a wonderful grandfather and a wonderful advocate for it. He's tirelessly looking for new horizons for us and for our kids, and it's amazing how he keeps an open perspective to autism as well, and looking and keeps looking for new horizons, and that is a true inspiration for us. It's, and because of that, I could introduce in the Netherlands as well some new ways of looking at to autism.
I do want to get to that, Pim. Ultimately, you traveled to this country to study with Stanley Greenspan. He's an expert, if not the expert, on autism, and he's the developer of the floor time treatment, which is widely accepted as the gold standard for autism treatment. I guess first I want to know, why did you come to this country? Weren't there any resources for you in the Netherlands?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's not that this is a third world country when it comes to treating autism, especially the last 10 years. It has taken off widely, and there is a very, very active society here who is promoting all the new ways and new developments on autism. So, but again, 10 years ago when, well, I think 12 years ago when I met through my father-in-law, Dr. Greenspan, we went to Bethesda with Julia, and that is my daughter with Jill. And so
your daughter Jill also is
my daughter Julia. Yeah,
she's also on the autism spectrum.
Yes, she's also on the autistic spectrum. She is. While Johan is really on the bad side, so to speak, he can talk. The world is really chaotic for him. You know, he has to fight the sensory demon, so to speak, practically every minute of his waking hours. So, for him, the world is at least the way we perceive it, it's not a world as that he can understand. While Julia, on the other hand, maybe thanks also to my boy Johan, we were there when we saw something with Julia. We were there very early, around 1.5 year old, and especially that early recognition of autism with Julia, that really set us immediately back to work, so to speak.
Pim, tell us
and
what...
Especially looking at it in a very down-to-earth way, not looking for the magic bullet, not looking for magical treatments, which you hear so much, but really we're looking for a way where the parents got a central role in the development of their child, because... And we were looking for ways and for a method, for a model, where the parent was considered as the expert of their child, and they are.
Pim, we've only got a couple of minutes left. I'm curious about the different systems in Holland and in America. Tell us what happens in Holland, just briefly, when a child has special needs.
We have what we call a personal budget system. It means that according to the degree of the autism or any other developmental delay, or you get awarded a yearly sum of money, which can exceed even in between, let's say, $5,000 in between $100,000. And
how does the country afford that?
Well, that is now a major debate, of course, because now we are also hit on, although not so much, I think, as any other country, by the economic crisis, but still, this system still works, and it works more efficiently than just to have it covered by other insurances.
Pim, are you personally worried about what will happen to you? Are you worried about what will happen to you if this system goes away?
Yeah, of course, because now they slowly start to give, let's say, occupational therapy, and that is now covered by your normal insurance, also physical therapy, but music therapy, play therapy, any developmental guidance by psychologists or a child psychologist or educationalists.
That's really worrisome.
It's not covered whatsoever, and that still has to come from this personal budget system. But again, they restrict it. But still, we are very fortunate that up till so far, it still works very well, and people are very grateful for that because it means that you can make your you really can look for the treatment your child really has to have, and so it gives the parent a central role in treating your child.
That's really an interesting approach, and I wish this country had the appetite to look at it, but I strongly doubt it. Pim Donkersloot, thank you so much for joining us and giving some insight about what happens in your country. I wish you the best. Take care. Pim is a developmental psychologist. He works with children on the autism spectrum, and he's got two children on the spectrum. He's written a book about his family called Autism is a Problem for the Entire Family. I also want to mention that on Friday, April 29th, LaSalle University is going to host a conference on autism called Voices of Advocacy. I'll deliver the keynote address in the morning. It'll be a wonderful event. If you want more information, it's gfpartnerships.org. gtpartnerships.org. Well, when we come back from our break, we're going to learn about a local family's connection to Morocco and a group of women who were sensitive to their son's life with autism. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. You can receive tax deductions for sustaining nonprofits across southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation works with financial advisors and administers donor-advised funds, charitable gift annuities, memorials, and scholarships. The Foundation takes care of all the details, making it easy for you to make a difference forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
Supporting WHYY, Philadelphia Theater Company concludes its main stage season with the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ruined by Lynn Nottage. Inspired by interviews conducted in Africa, Ruined is a powerful and life-affirming story which celebrates human strength and dignity with humor and song against the backdrop of war-torn Congo. Tickets for Ruined, running May 20th through June 12th, available at 215-985-0420 or philadelphiatheatercompany.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. I am here in the studio with Ashrif Uwida. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes. For short, first name, say Ash.
Ash. Okay. I thank you for that. He's a doctor here in Philadelphia. He's originally from Egypt, and his wife is from Morocco. They have two children, a five-year-old daughter and a seven-year-old son named Faris. Faris has autism and was sent away to be in a program run by parents of autistic children in Morocco. He's back in Philadelphia now, but he'll likely return to the program in Morocco, where his family feels he's most comfortable. Ash, thanks so much for joining us and taking time out of your schedule. Your son Faris is nonverbal. Now, he was born here in Philadelphia, so you discovered his autism here. What were you seeing?
Just Faris showed a lot of symptoms and signs of atypical behavior. And we took him to one of the local neuropediatrician in the University of Pennsylvania. And he was diagnosed at the age of almost 14 or 15 months of age.
You are fortunate in that you're a physician, so you knew to take him to a developmental physician.
Correct.
Many pediatricians overlook it.
Yes, so we took him to a specialist in the area, so we were able to get an early diagnosis.
So what services were you receiving here, and how did you get them?
Originally, we were with Elwyn Seeds Program. in Philadelphia, and this has lasted for almost 18 months. And then Faris had to go, because of his age, beyond 5 years of age, to go to the school district. Then at this time, the mother wanted to just take a break and have some extra support from her family in Morocco. And this is where we discovered we have a program there in the town she would like to live in.
How old was he then?
Faris was almost 6 and maybe 6 few months, years old.
Had he ever been to Morocco?
Yes, we visit Morocco often. We visit to go to our vacation maybe once or twice a year into Morocco.
And Egypt? Do you go back to Egypt?
We go, but not that often.
Hmm. Is he able to understand?
Yes, actually, surprisingly, he can understand in both languages, in English and Arabic.
Uh-huh, but he can't speak.
No, he cannot verbally communicate. He can communicate by other means.
Yeah. How does he communicate?
He either pulls your hand and walks you to wherever he would like you, to like water, food, some sort of this manner. One interesting point in Morocco, which is this one of the ecstatic things we acquired, in the first six months of his tenure in the school there, he was able to be toilet trained, which was a great challenge as he overcame there.
What did they do that we didn't? Do you know?
I would say most likely the support, the school support, the family support, the extra hand you have. So there was almost around 18 hours around the clock, every half an hour they take him into the party.
So let's come back to this country for a minute.
Yes, yes.
You talked a bit about the support you got. I wonder what was available, what were the finances, what about insurance issues?
In the United States, definitely we did not have any of that. Just we have the regular bureaucratic things. You go through the regular route, whatever times you go through the analysis, investigation, and you go into the program you are assigned to. On the other hand, in Morocco, if you would like to make the comparison, it is completely financed by the parents. So there is no governmental route, there is no big social network you can lean on. Everything will be personally and privately financed.
What about people who can't afford it?
This is another interesting point. The class Faris joined in this private NGO organization called Otesma was only 8 children in the class. There was actually a child of a poor family, which didn't have the means to be able to afford that. And my wife and I would try to, I would say my wife, mainly I'm here in the States. They tried to get the other parents to be partially dividing the tuition of this child by 8 families.
That's wonderful.
Yep.
But what about the larger poor culture in Morocco? How do they survive?
This is actually interesting. You're not even talking about people to afford these kind of programs or services. You are even talking about people who can afford it and they cannot find enough services. So in a country which is almost 34 million population, there's only maybe 3 or 4 psychologists who are specialized in autism services. So most of their services, they come at a third party by contracting with somebody from France or Canada where they speak the French language. And this is definitely a big challenge. And if you may, I have definitely a good idea to introduce more education into this kind of highly specialized education. I'm not sure about Morocco universities. I mean the current governmental universities, public universities. But I'm aware about a private American academia being built in Morocco. And hopefully, maybe, this can be one of the areas where you can give master's and PhDs in this area.
Yeah, you heard the interview earlier with Stephen Schur.
Yes.
We've got to get him out to Morocco, along with my dear friend and colleague, Rab Nassif.
Yes, definitely, Bob. Yes, I would love to have Robert go and visit there. And he promised, once we are able to make all the logistics for that.
Good, Good. Maybe I'll go with them.
Great.
I want to get a bit into the psychology of this. From what I know of Middle Eastern cultures, mothers tend to stay very close to their babies. And I don't know what Faris was like when he was younger. A lot of babies on the autism spectrum, and certainly toddlers, can't tolerate that closeness. They reject it. Was Faris like that?
I would say on the contrary. Faris always showed high affection to his father. And this was one of the big concerns going to Morocco, because I work here. And I think he tolerated well this separation and going there.
How about you?
I try to visit often, as much as my schedule allows. So every 2 to 3 months I was able to fly and go there for 2 weeks or so.
But what's it like for you to have him there?
I try to keep myself busy. So if I know he's doing well, and whatever I have seen in every visit I go there, I see there is little bit. For Faris is a big jump, but it is little bit of improvement. I think I'll be satisfied, which I was.
You've got, where's your daughter?
Sarah in the school now, in the daycare, private daycare here in Center City.
So she's with you, and your wife, by and large, is
correct.
Is with Faris.
Yes, yes.
That's difficult for a family. It's stressful.
Definitely is. And I think this is very interesting comparison between the American society in large and the Moroccan society, if I may add.
Please.
In Morocco, my wife, I think she felt very, very comfortable in comparison with here. And I think there was three main factors for that. One, the society in general, they always have some sort, I'm not sure, of sympathy or some sort of humbling for anybody who has disability.
Humbling?
You see it in the supermarket. You see it in the public places, in the park. If Faris, for example, start to shout or start to make sound,
yes,
trying to express himself in a given way. Here, I have noticed people will look into a way that they show they are disturbed. In Morocco, people, the same circumstances, people will not show they are disturbed. On the contrary, they will come closer and maybe kiss him or, you know, say certain kind of, you know, condolence thing or something to support, especially as a mother. You know, God bless you, or, you know, take care of yourself, something like that.
I don't know what the expression on my face looks like, but I've got to tell you my reaction to that. I am surprised and intrigued and confused, and I want to know how that happened.
Likewise, myself. I have several circumstances where I witness this kind of things, which it's partially, I think, we are getting more and more in our society educated about when a kid behaves in a certain way, maybe there's something behind that. But unfortunately, my personal experience is we are not there yet. Maybe we are slowly going to be there. But if the child didn't show facial features of he is retarded or is different, usually people interpret this first as he's not well-behaved, not well-mannered, rather than he has limitation or autism, for example.
I want to know why you are closer to being there than this culture is. I want to know, and I know you can't answer this, I want to know what you're doing right over there as a culture that we are not. It certainly is not about academic education.
As I said, in my opinion, autism, there are three big factors to handle a given limited or a challenged child. Is the society in large, the family, and the support they get in between.
Yeah, we've been talking about Morocco. What about Egypt? What?
I will not be able to say a lot about Egypt. I don't have a personal experience seeing the education, but I do have communication with what is the services being rendered there. Because this was one of the options. Is it Egypt or Morocco will make the family, you know, more comfortable during their vacation? So it seems it is Morocco, and especially Marrakesh, which is a town in southern Morocco.
Yeah, and you certainly wouldn't be comfortable in Egypt these days.
No, actually, on the contrary, I was there during all this uprising. I was
really?
Visiting. I was visiting my parents by accident, and this happened there. you know, we had more stuff to talk about. So.
I'll bet you did.
Yes,
yes. I'll bet you did. Are your parents okay?
Yes, they are.
And are they looking forward to a new world in Egypt?
Yeah, actually, yeah, everybody there is very, very excited about what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, one way or the other, it's going to be a new world.
Yes, yes.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, although I do have a final question that I wanted to get a feel for, if I may, your marriage and what this does to your marriage.
Any problem I would look at or any challenge I would look at, I would look at from an academic point of view. And we have challenges. We'll try to overcome it.
I hear you.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been rich and informative.
Thank you.
My guest has been Shraif Uwaida. Ash is what he wants to be called. He's been sharing his story of how his multicultural family has come to understand the needs of his autistic son, Faris. Early in the show, I spoke with Pim Dunkersloot. He works with autistic children and has written a book about raising two autistic children. We also heard earlier from David Mandel of the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, and Stephen Shore, who's on the autism spectrum, and he lectures on the topic of autism around the world. Special thanks to my dear friend Rob Nassif, who we referred to earlier in the show. Next week on Voices in the Family, we hope you show your continued support for our show as we kick off our spring membership drive. I also want to mention that on Friday, April 29th, LaSalle University will host the Voices of Advocacy Autism Conference. I'll deliver the keynote speech. It's going to be a great event. I'd love to see you out there. You can get more information by going to gtpartnerships.org. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. And I want you to remember, we're podcasting Voices shows. Look for us on iTunes. And of course, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Emily Haas is our intern. Me? Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.